worked out?
I hope so.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. Good song leading. Well, it's good to see everybody today. I'm glad that you're here. I hope that you've got your Bible with you and that you'll think about some of the things we're going to discuss this morning. Just to give you kind of a heads up, this week, beginning this afternoon, we're going to look at some passages from the book of Matthew. I'm real excited about that. I've shared these messages from Matthew. I've shared them about every place that I've ever had opportunity to go. Not because I think that I just created some masterwork sermons, but I think that these are just the messages that Matthew is presenting, that Matthew is preaching, that God wants us to hear. And I'll tell you that they're life-changing. I'm convinced of that. They've changed the way I think. They've changed my attitude about so very many things. They've just changed me from the inside out. They've changed me from the inside. I hope that's working its way out. But I'm convinced that these are some of the very best sermons that I have. But they're, again, not because they're my sermons. It's Matthew's sermons, and they are transformative. So this afternoon, we're going to look at the Sermon on the Mount. Christianity concentrated. It's an introduction to all of Christianity, the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to talk about that this afternoon. Probably tomorrow we'll look at Matthew chapter 9. Three times compassion and mercy are mentioned in Matthew chapter 9. There's something to that. Why is it that people see Jesus, even worldly people see Jesus as compassionate, but when they think about church people, His disciples, compassion is not the first thing, if ever, something that they associate church people with. There's something there in Matthew chapter 9 that we really need to hear. We'll probably talk about Matthew chapter 11, John the Baptist, his questions. What do we do when Jesus isn't what we expect? When following Jesus, when being a Christian, when all of our expectations, when things don't work out the way that they're supposed to, when things don't work out the way that we think that they ought to, when Jesus isn't what we expect, what do we do? I think we can all admit, at least to ourselves, we ought to admit that there are times in our lives, and maybe large parts of our lives, where things have not worked out the way that we thought they were going to. So what do you do with Jesus when He isn't what you thought? We'll probably talk about James and John when they want to be seated on the left and right hand of Jesus at some point. Here's a demonstration of true commitment, great commitment. We want to be with you, Jesus. We'll do anything that you ask us to do. You just make us your lieutenants, and if you need a job done, we'll do it. We're on your side, Jesus. I think that's really what they're saying. They demonstrate commitment. We want to think about what really true great commitment looks like. We'll talk about that a little bit. And then one of them that I think is just so powerful, at least it's the one that speaks and resonates with me so very much, is Matthew 16, where Peter confesses Jesus. He confesses his faith. I believe, Jesus. I believe that you're the King. I believe that you're the Messiah, that you're the Christ. And then right after that, Jesus talks about his death, and Peter says, we're not going to talk like that. That's not going to happen. I'm not going to let that happen to you, Jesus. And you might remember in Matthew chapter 16 that Jesus rebukes Peter and rebukes him really strongly, saying, "Get behind me, Satan." Peter has confidence in Jesus, the man, but he's not as confident in God's method, and his method is the cross. That's one for us really to wrestle with. We all believe in Jesus. I'm sure you believe in Jesus, but are you willing to believe in God's method? Take up your cross and follow Him. So we'll think about that a little bit as well. And there's probably one more in there I'll throw. We'll figure out what other one we're going to throw in there. But anyway, I'm going to tell you that these are life-changing. Or at least they're life-changing to me, and I hope I can share that passion with you. This morning, is not a sermon on the book of Matthew. I want to think with you for just a few moments this morning about reaching the next generation, passing the torch off to the next generation. How do we do that? Or is it even possible? Can we reach the next generation? I hope so. About a year ago, I say it's a recent social media post, but it was recently a year ago when I gave this sermon up at Robinson. A year ago, back in March, actually, I went back and looked it up. It was in March that a fellow preacher, and pretty well known, and I have a lot of respect for him in a lot of things, but he wrote a post on Facebook and kind of lamented the condition of churches of the modern day, that we're losing our young people. And of course, you know what? When I was a young person myself, I remember preachers talking about how we're losing our young people. And you know what? In about 30 years from today, preachers are still going to be talking about how we're losing our young people. Probably back in the second century, they were talking about we're losing our young people. It just seems to be that as we get older, we think about our children and our grandchildren. They're important to us. And so we begin worrying about their faith. Is their faith going to be as strong as my faith? And so often we'd like to just be able to take their heads and open them up and just dump stuff in. We'd like to do that with a whole lot. We'd like to do that in a whole lot of areas of life, but it just doesn't work that way. And so how do we reach the next generation? So he wrote this post and he lamented several different things. He talks about how young people today, I don't guess he's talking about millennials anymore. Millennials have grown up, right? You know, you're an old person if you're millennial now. It's Gen Z now. And so what do they want? Well, they want what he described. They want passion over passive. Passion over passive. You can tell he's a preacher. You can tell he's a good preacher because he makes things, you know, well, it's not really rhyming, but he uses the same letter for both words. That's important for preachers to do things like that. We want relevant over boring. You think young people want relevant sermons, relevant church? You think they want relevant things over boring things? Yeah. Do you, older people? Do you want relevant things over boring things, or do you like boring church? Come on, we all do, right? We all do. Our young people, they want doers over talkers. Yeah. Yeah, but I suspect that young people are not the only ones that want doers over talkers or mission over money. Yeah, I think that's true, and love over apathy. I think all of that's true. Yes, that's true. That's what our young people, that's what our children and our grandchildren, that's what they want. But I don't know that it's really any different than what the generations before wanted. I mean, we can think about millennials or Gen Z, and we can say, well, that's what they want. And of course, the millennials are always being compared to the baby boomers. I'm Gen X, and so we just got forgotten there in the middle. So we didn't even exist. But they're always being compared to the baby boomers. Do you suppose that the baby boomers of the 1960s, do you not suppose that they might have wanted those very same things? Yeah, I think so. I think so. And yet we have new models, and we have new technology, and we have new methods, right? We do this with the church, but it's true in other things as well, right? The philosophy of education. When I was in school, especially when I was in elementary school, if you had a deficiency in learning, if you had a challenge in learning, if you learned with difficulty, then you got isolated and put in a special classroom for the learning disabled. You know, they don't do that kind of thing anymore. It's a different philosophy now. I was reading something this past week about the way children learn to read, and there's a discrepancy. Some teach reading by sounding out words. That's how I was taught how to read, was to sound out the letters, and you learn a word that way. And it has its own problems, right? Because English is not always spelled, the spelling is not always phonetic. But other people learn to read by words. You just memorize the word itself. And there's deficiencies, or there's challenges with that. But it's a difference of philosophy, right? I homeschooled my kids, and I remember when we first started homeschooling, we set a classroom up. We had desks, We had little chairs with a desk on it, and we had a flag, and every morning the kids would get up and they would say the Pledge of Allegiance, because I remember doing that when I was in elementary school. And we had a whiteboard, and you know, we just had class time. I don't know that class has to be that way. I don't know that school has to be that way. By the time the kids got older, we were not pledging allegiance, and we weren't sitting at desks. We sat around the kitchen table a lot or in the living room. I've got a picture of one of my daughters actually doing her schoolwork on top of her dog. We do different things. In church, we often have pews, and we have the lectern here, and we give lectures. But do you suppose that we couldn't do church? Do you suppose that we couldn't worship God if we didn't have pews? Share this with you. So at Robinson's where I normally preach and where we normally work, there's just a few of us now at Robinson, less than 10 of us now. And so sometimes when someone will call in and say, well, you know, I'm not going to be able to make it in tonight. And so then there might be just four or five of us on a Wednesday night. And do you think, how uncomfortable would that be to be able to stand in front of three or four other people, all scattered throughout the pews, three or four other people, and stand at the pulpit or stand at a podium and do Bible class that way? For me, that's just uncomfortable. And so what I've become doing is I'll just go and sit down in the pews with them, and we just kind of sit there together. And I thought, you know what would really be a great idea is I should bring in some folding chairs and maybe a card table or something, and we could just move. We could just make this space. We've got a space like this there, Robinson. We could just make that space right there, and we could just sit there together. And it does change the atmosphere, but it makes conversation a whole lot more accessible. Couldn't we do that? Well, sure. Well, we kind of get fixed on these models and technologies and different things going on. I want you to look at this passage in the book of 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians. And as we read through this, what is it that Paul's bringing to the Corinthians? He talks about this, 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and the first five verses. What is it that Paul brought? 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 1. And when I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. That's kind of strange to think about the Apostle Paul being scared. But I think that's what he's describing there. Much trembling, wouldn't you suppose? And my message, verse 4, and my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith would not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. What is it that Paul brought? Now, some might suggest that he brought miracles. And I think that that can be applied to what he's saying here, that Paul has miracles and he's able to confirm the message that he's preaching by demonstrating God's power in these miraculous works. Now, I think that that can be understood that way, but I'm going to suggest to you that there's something else that Paul brought in the power of God to change people's lives. And Paul himself is a key example of that very reality, that meeting Jesus changed this man completely. You think about the apostles, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. These men are changed dramatically from time with Jesus. Or Levi, the tax collector, and Simon the Zealot. These men are changed dramatically because of their time with Jesus. I would suggest to you that that's what's being expressed here. Paul says, I've come to you, and I didn't just come to persuade you with my passionate words or my Loctite logical arguments. I've come and I've demonstrated changed lives to you. Can we reach the next generation I absolutely believe that we can. I believe we can. I'm confident we can. I'm confident that we can reach the next generation as all generations before have been reached. Yeah, I believe that we can because one generation really isn't any different than another. I know we want to think that we're also very special, but we're really not any different than generations that have gone before. When there at Robinson on Wednesday nights, we have been going through the Old Testament, and we've read through most of the history of the Old Testament, and then we got into Isaiah. Right now, we're going through the book of Jeremiah, and I don't know how many times as we've gone through all of the Old Testament history, all of the triumphs of faithful men and all of the idolatry and the wickedness of rebellious Israel. We think about the prophets and all of the things God warns the people about throughout their message. One of the things that keeps coming up over and over and over and over again is that no matter that these people live at a different time and they have a different culture than ours and they speak a different language than we do and they probably ate different food than we do, they all worry about the same things. They all want the same kinds of things that we want. People today are not different than people have been in the past. Even though we may be separated by hundreds of years, separated by thousands of miles, and our cultures could be so very different from one another, and we couldn't even communicate if we met one another, we're really not any different. We want the same things. We're afraid of the same things. We have the same worries and the same concerns. One generation is not any different than generations that have come before. In the book of 1 John in chapter 2 and verse 16, John says, all that's in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life, not from the Father, but from the world. Is that any different today? It was present in the Garden of Eden in the very beginning. It's present there in the temptations of Jesus. It's present because John's talking about it when he writes this epistle. And it's true today. Are we really any different than generations before? So the generation to come after, are they going to be really any different than we are right now? No. No. So what is the Scripture's model? Well, we can talk about different models and philosophies of how to reach the next generation. We need to have this computer program, or we need to have that kind of workbook, or maybe we don't need workbooks anymore because we've got a different philosophy on how to communicate. Maybe we just need social media posts. We could do Instagram Bible class or something. Whatever ridiculousness, right? What is the Scripture's model for generational teaching? That's what we want to know. What does God say will work? That's what I want to know. Four things. First of all, grab their attention. Now, I think I see this in the Scriptures. Don't you? See if you don't see it. When God brought the children of Israel out of Egyptian bondage, where does He take them? He takes them to Mount Sinai. And what happens at Mount Sinai? God speaks, right? The cloud of God's glory descends on the mountain, and it is gloomy, and it is dark, and it is frightening. Do you think God has their attention? And fire, and lightning, and smoke, do you think God has their attention? And then His voice thunders from above them. Do you think He has their attention? So much so that the people say, Moses, you'll go talk to God. Tell us what He has to say. I don't think we can stand another moment of hearing His voice. God has their attention. I want to read this passage from the book of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 12. Wow, this is a really great passage. Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 18. Verse 18. For you have not come to a mountain that can be touched, and to a blazing fire, and to darkness and gloom and whirlwind, and to the blast of the trumpet at the sound of the words, which sound was so that those who heard begged that no further word be spoken to them. For they could not bear the commandment, if even a beast touches the mountain, it will be stoned. Why would God give that kind of commandment? How do you keep a dumb animal from doing what dumb animals do? I don't know if some of you might have raised cattle or something. My ex-in-laws, they had cattle, and every once in a while, one of them would get out of the fence. I don't know how, but they figure ways of getting out, and they never figure out how to get back in. But they'd be out on the road or something. You'd have to go and fetch them and bring them back in. It's a dumb animal. Doesn't know any better. So why does God say that even if a dumb animal that doesn't know any better touches the mountain, it's going to be stoned? Why? So you pay all the more attention to it. This is really serious. That's what's being said here. So much so that he goes on to the very end and he says, "For our God is a consuming fire." That last verse there. This is really serious. Do you suppose the people that came out to Mount Sinai, that God had their attention? He absolutely had their attention. Or a little bit further in the book of Isaiah, you'll remember maybe in Isaiah chapter 6, this is where Isaiah has this vision of being in God's throne room. And this is the part where God says, "Who will we send?" And Isaiah just volunteers and says, here am I, send me. I wonder sometimes if Moses or Isaiah just says it. He doesn't know what to say and he just blurts something out. Peter often did that. He just blurts something out. "Here I am, send me." He's just wrapped up in the moment of it. Does God have Isaiah's attention? Absolutely. Sometimes what we see in the Bible is that when God has a big mission for one of these people, like Moses or like Elijah or Peter, James, and John on the Mountain of Transfiguration, when they have this big mission, he gives them this big view of himself. And that's really what happens in Isaiah. How many times does Isaiah describe God as the Holy One of Israel? You know, when you read through Isaiah, you get this picture of who God is. And if I can see God as the Holy One of Israel, see him more clearly, the more clearly I can see God in his glory, the more clearly I can see my place in his work. Does God have his attention? Or how about this? I love this. In Luke chapter 8, been going through Luke now, and I don't do it consistently there at Robinson, but from time to time I'll do a sermon from the book of Luke. And it seems so interesting to me here in these chapters where Jesus has told parables to the disciples. Are you paying attention, disciples? Oh, yeah, we hear what you're saying, Jesus. We get the message. But they don't get the message. And he tells them to be careful how you listen. Verse 18 of chapter 8. Chapter 8 and verse 18. So take care how you listen. And I think that's interesting. It doesn't say who you listen to, but how you listen. Are you listening, disciples? Oh, yes, of course we're listening. The very next thing is Jesus is on the sea with the disciples and this great storm blows up. Do you think that the disciples are paying attention now? They might have been like me. I remember being a kid in elementary school and teachers, one of the mistakes teachers would make would be to sit boys like me beside the window. And we would just look out the window and daydream about all the things we weren't able to do because we were in school. I wonder if the disciples didn't have that same experience. You know, they've heard Jesus. They've been hearing Jesus. We've heard this message before Jesus. And they're just with him. And they're paying attention. Of course, they're paying attention. I mean, they're the disciples. They're the apostles. Of course, they're paying attention. But they're really not paying attention. And so they go out on the sea and a storm blows up. Jesus has their attention now. Grab the attention. Now, I'm not going to suggest that every sermon or that every service is going to be this magnetic moment where everybody's going to be just wrapped up in everything that's going on. That it's just going to be this life-changing experience every single week. I'm not suggesting that. But it is something that we need to think about. We need to get the attention of people. That's the biblical model. And then be a true believer yourself. You cannot convince somebody else to do what you're unwilling to do yourself. You've heard this about leaders, right? Leaders lead from the front. Be a true believer yourself. I mean, think about the apostles. Here are men that changed the world, that turned the world upside down because they truly believe. Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2 and verse 32. Acts 2 and verse 32. This Jesus, Peter says, this Jesus God raised up, to which we are all witnesses. And then this Peter is persecuted with John. They're threatened. And it's a serious threat because the men that are threatening them didn't have any problem murdering Jesus. They're not going to have any problem getting rid of Peter and John. This is a real threat. And so after they were released, Peter and John go back to the other disciples, the other apostles, and relate the threats. And then they pray. Read this with me. This is Acts chapter 3. Acts chapter 3. I'm going to come down beyond verse 15, down to verse 23. And it will be that every soul that does not... And it will be that every soul that does not heed the prophet shall be utterly destroyed from among the people. So this is their prayer. And likewise, all the prophets who have spoken... No, that's not the one I want. It's chapter 5. Yeah, I'm sorry. It's chapter... chapter 5. Chapter 5. Well, maybe it's not. I'm having trouble finding where I wanted. It's where they go out and they speak with boldness. The place where they are is shaken, and then they go out and they preach with boldness. But I'm not seeing it. I'm thinking it's at the end of chapter 5, but I don't see it. Anyway, let me move on. We want to be true believers. We want to be genuine, honest. We want to be passionate. And I think there are passages that demonstrate this. Here's what Paul says when he writes to Timothy about this kind of work in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5. 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5. Paul says, but the goal of our instruction, this is our aim, this is what we're after. The goal of our instruction is love. And it's motivated from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. He contrasts that in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 17 with those that preach from other motivations. But he says that's not our motivation. Or this passage in the book of Philippians. Philippians, the first chapter. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 21. Peter says, Paul says, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. I'm all about Jesus. Paul is all about Jesus. You read that first chapter of Philippians. Paul will talk about his imprisonment and he'll talk about people that are maybe trying to make him jealous with their preaching. He'll talk about different situations. But he talks about all of these things just long enough to get back to talking about Jesus. Jesus is everything. Everything to Paul. He's a true believer. There's no doubt that he makes converts. He believes what he's saying. And I think there are a number of other passages we could go to. I'm going to skip over some of this stuff. Be a true believer and then do. Practice what you preach. Now, I know you believe. I know you believe. What are you doing about it? You got all the answers up here. What are you doing with them? Practice what you preach. We talked a little bit about this in Bible class this morning, this passage in Matthew chapter 23. Here are people that have seated themselves in this position of authority, the chair of Moses, and they're going to tell everybody else what to do because they know, and we've got the authority. but don't do anything themselves. Practice what you preach. Otherwise, we'll be hypocrites, right? Have you heard people who have left the church and you ask them why? And one of the responses, and I don't think it's always fair. I don't think it's as true as often as it is related. But I do think that sometimes it's true. Do you ever go and ask somebody who's left the church or that has left the faith, why? And they say, because the church is full of hypocrites. Again, I don't think that that's fair, because I don't think the church is full of hypocrites. I certainly don't think the Lord's body is full of hypocrites, because I think the Lord disowned hypocrites. But are there church people that are hypocritical? Yeah. Yeah, there are. You want to know how to reach the next generation? The same way that we reach every generation before. Be what you proclaim to be. Do what you preach. We're not going to cover Mark this week, but in Mark chapter 12, let me just show you what's going on here. Mark chapter 12. I think this is brilliant. It's brilliant when you read the chapter, when you see the message that Mark is preaching. This is great. So in Mark chapter 12, Jesus is arguing with different religious groups. So the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the scribes. And they're arguing. They're discussing things back and forth over and over and over. Jesus is having these conversations with all of these spiritual men. They know the scriptures, they've got their arguments, and they speak back and forth, right? Jesus responds and they respond, and they respond and Jesus responds. So you have this conversation going on with all these different groups. And then notice what happens at the very end of the chapter. Go down to verse 38. In his teaching, he was saying, "Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and like respectful greetings in the marketplaces. They put on a pretense, and chief seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets, who devour widows' houses and for appearance' sake offer long prayers. They like to talk." To offer long prayers, they like to talk. And then notice the way he keys up. He talks about them devouring widows' houses. And then verse 41. Jesus is sitting opposite the treasury and he began to observe. He's watching. He began to observe how the people were putting money into the treasury. And many rich people were putting in large sums. And a poor widow came and put in 2 small copper coins, which amount to a cent. And calling his disciples to him, he said to them, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all the contributors to the treasury. For they put in all out of their surplus, but she out of her poverty put in all that she had to live on." What did she say? What did she say? This whole chapter, chapter 12, has been... The whole chapter has been about what the Sadducees say and what the Pharisees say and what the scribes say and all the things that they're talking about. What did she say? I don't remember reading anything that she said, but I read something about what she did. Now, all the things that the Sadducees said and the Pharisees said and the scribes said, what did they do? We can spend a lot of time... We can spend a lot of time thinking up brilliant arguments to combat that error, to combat that false teaching. We can come up with all kinds of arguments. But what do you do? What are you doing? Practice what you preach. I'm going to jump through some of this. Lastly, teach what's true. Again, how do you reach the next generation? Do you need a new model? Do we need new technology? Better technology? something more flashy? What do we need to reach the next generation? The same thing that we've used to reach every generation before and every generation to come. Teach them what's true. I mean, if it's not true, then what have you really won them to? You may keep them in the church building, but have you kept them in the faith? Teach them what's true. So Paul finishes his letter to Timothy, and it's interesting. This is 2 Timothy. This is, in a sense, these are Paul's last words to his son in the faith. This young man that Paul has been with for so much time and has treated like his own son. Paul and Timothy are not together at the moment. And so Paul sends this letter to Timothy, and he's asking Timothy to come quickly, come before winter, bring certain things with you. And it seems that Timothy doesn't make it in time. And so these are the last words that this aged man has to share with this young man that's so dear and close to him. And so he tells Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 2, preach the word. He doesn't say anything about models and technology and preach the word. Teach what's true. Preach the word. It's not more complicated than that. Be a true believer. Practice what you preach. And preach what's true. It's not complicated. And the refrain of the prophets of the Old Testament is always, thus saith the Lord. Just teach the truth. Now, I understand. I'm going to finish this way. I understand that you can do all of those things, and that does not guarantee that the next generation or all of the next generation or any of the next generation, it doesn't guarantee that any of them are going to listen or absorb the faith that you have. I understand it doesn't guarantee it. All you can do is sow the seed into their heart. And the way you do it is by being a true believer yourself, practicing what you preach, and preaching the truth. Now, if there's someone here this morning that needs to put Jesus Christ on in baptism, we're here and we're ready to help you. If there's someone here that is discouraged and beat down, we want to pray with you. And we invite you to come while we stand and sing.